As the term white supremacy is uttered, perhaps for the first time so commonly in the U.S., the psychiatrist Dr. Francis Kress Welsing packs the room for a talk about race and racism. And will Monday's White House Conference on Aging take action about the crisis in care for our elders and address the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow that continues to shortchange home care workers? All that and more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for July 9th, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around the blue planet. I'm Esther Averam. Well, on today's show, the psychiatrist Dr. Francis Kress Welsing packs the room for a talk about race and racism. And in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Caitlin Connolly of the National Employment Law Project about the White House Conference on Aging that is coming up this Monday. Will the conference really address the crisis in home care and health care for our elders? So, as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with this week's activism headlines. As Gaza marks 1 year since the launch of Israel's 50-day assault, it remains in a state of crisis. The assault killed 2,200 Palestinians, including 550 children. On the Israeli side, 73 people were killed, all but six of them soldiers. A year later, none of the 12,000 homes destroyed in Gaza have been rebuilt, in part due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. A recent United Nations report found serious violations of international humanitarian law, which may amount to war crimes by Israeli forces and to a lesser extent by Palestinian militants during the assault. Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omar spoke to Democracy Now! This week from Gaza.
Gaza is still living the same situation as right after the war and during the war. The only thing that we don't have Israeli F-16s overhead flying, and we don't have the Israeli drones flying overhead, but we still have a lot of damages that are caused as a result of the war, and nothing has been fixed. Not one single home has been built after the war. Gaza is still struggling to survive. People are still struggling to get back to pick their lives from the beginning. The people of Gaza are hoping that there will be some moves by the Palestinian Authority to take Israel into the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We don't know if this is going to be happening anytime soon, but the spirits of the Gazans is quite strong today, I would say, despite the fact that they are now mourning those that they have lost, and they are remembering the days of the war and the agony, the days that they have lived during the month of Ramadan just last year when Israel bombed the Gaza Strip for 51 days.
The World Bank is warning the Gaza economy, already in shambles after the 2007 attack by Israel, remains on the verge of collapse. The South Carolina House voted early this morning to remove the Confederate battle flag from the Capitol grounds. The vote came after last month's massacre of 9 African-American churchgoers in Charleston by a white suspect who embraced the flag representing the slaveholding South defeated in the Civil War. Bree Newsom, the activist who climbed the flagpole at the South Carolina Capitol and removed the Confederate flag, told WPFW's Voices with Vision this week that the significance of the flag's removal should not be downplayed.
I think that we should be careful not to downplay too much the significance of shifting opinions on the Confederate flag, because even though it is a flag, even though it is just a symbol, it's a very powerful symbol, and it really is a symbol of terror and intimidation. Mm-hmm. And a state endorsement of white supremacy. And as somebody pointed out to me, there has never been like revolutionary change that doesn't include the removal of monuments and things that stand for the old order that people no longer agree with. It's not going to resolve all of the systemic issues that we're dealing with by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. But I think it's still an important victory, especially as black people in the South. And as someone who, you know, I've had a family member who was lynched, I've had family members tell me about, you know, terrorism from the Klan. I mean, this is a very real thing.
Mm.
Even in my decision to take down the flag, I'm facing possible danger of retaliation from white supremacist groups for that. So this is still something that, you know, we live with, and I think it's a really important moment for the state to no longer endorse it.
Also on Tuesday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced plans to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate police killings of unarmed civilians. Cuomo said Tuesday he will appoint New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman under a one-year executive order. The move will make New York the first state to institute an independent prosecutor for police killings. Cuomo's move came as thousands are mobilizing for a massive rally next Saturday, July 18th in New York City, to mark 1 year since Eric Garner died after a police chokehold on Staten Island. Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, joined other mothers of New Yorkers killed by police in a rally outside Cuomo's New York City office.
We want justice for all, not for just some. And just with the 1 year, 1 year is not enough. But he promised us that he would broaden the scope. It wouldn't only be for 1 year. He would renew it after 1 year. And it wouldn't be just for unarmed killings, because we know how things go. It's not on, sometimes they'll say the person was armed and the person was not armed. We've seen South Carolina. We've seen different cases. But thank God for the videotape.
That was Gwen Carr, mother of Eric Garner. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Daniel Pantaleo, who put Garner in the fatal chokehold that was viewed on video by millions around the world. The prosecutor in the case, Daniel Donovan, was recently elected to Congress. Also in New York, at least 9 people were arrested Tuesday as hundreds took part in direct actions against oil and gas extraction in Vermont and upstate New York. Protesters blockaded trucks carrying frack gas in Addison County, Vermont, blocked construction on a frack gas pipeline in Williston, and staged a lake flotilla in Ticonderoga, New York. Using the slogan, "Not by truck, not by rail, not by pipeline," organizers denounced attempts to make the Champlain Valley into an oil and gas corridor. The events are part of a week of action marking the second anniversary of the Lac Mégantic oil train derailment, which killed 47 people in Quebec. And finally, in our culture and media moment, there's some breaking news about the Washington football team. For the first time in a legal battle that has stretched for over 20 years, a federal judge on yesterday ordered the cancellation of the trademark registration for the Washington football team, ruling that the team name may be disparaging to Native Americans. So that's a big victory for activists who've been battling for decades for that issue. And opening tomorrow here in D.C. is the play It's What We Do by Pamela Nice. The play is based on testimony of Israeli soldiers about war crimes committed on the people of Gaza by Israeli Defense Forces. It's What We Do opens at the Atlas Theater Lab as part of the Capital Fringe Festival. More information is at capitalfringe.org. On this Saturday from 5 to 7 p.m., yours truly will join other members of Black Artists of D.C. at the Brentwood Arts Exchange for an artist talk for the exhibit At War With Ourselves, The Battle of and for the Black-Faced Boy, a visual arts response to a poem by Nikki Finney. That's the Brentwood Arts Exchange, 3901 Rhode Island Avenue in Brentwood, Maryland. And on Tuesday, July 14th from 4 to 6 p.m., artist Anne Bowie will hold a talk about her show, Balm and Gilead, at the Gallery of Wesley Theological Seminary, 4500 Massachusetts Avenue in Northwest D.C. That's the Wesley Theological Seminary this Tuesday, July 14th from 4 to 6 p.m. And last on the ground was in Columbia, Maryland recently, where urban herbologist Charlene Muhammad was celebrating the one-year anniversary of her Peaceful Gathering Studio, a unique space devoted to yoga and other forms of traditional healing. She said that activists have a special need to care for our overall well-being.
Every individual has a responsibility to the life that they're given. And we are first charged to take care of that life that we're given. So spirituality or spiritual practice is a personal thing first. And if you can come into your own self from that space, then you're more able to give out and teach others. So particularly for activists, I think, who are naturally empathic and they have a natural compassion that's there. But sometimes that they're so busy exhaling that they never take that entail. They never think about doing something for themselves to take care of themselves. The other thing is that, you know, our understanding and learning is on different layers. Okay, so from the person in the street to the person in the White House, we're all on different levels of understanding in our walk. And so we have to be able to understand where everyone is at on their level and be able to teach on that level in order to guide folks. We all don't, it's not one thought, you know. So from a spiritual perspective, first and foremost, it's a self-study.
Well, those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, what is race? We'll go to Busboys and Poets, where Dr. Francis Cresswell sing Pack the House with a talk not just about race, but racism. You don't want to miss that. Stay with us.
The ground beneath my feet, I know, was made for me. There is no any one place where I belong. My spirit's meant to be free, and so now everyone will see. Life was made for us to be what we want to be. And if it's your world, it's yours and yours and yours. You want to see what's not meant for me. Your world, you don't have to be lonely within your world. You are truly free.
Well, as the term white supremacy is uttered, perhaps for the first time so commonly in the U.S. by the U.S. media and talk shows, etc., the psychiatrist Dr. Francis Cresswell Singh packs the room for a talk about race and racism. And this happened on Sunday at Busboys and Poets, the 14th and V location. Frances Cresswell Singh is a psychiatrist who, with her 1970 essay, The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism, offered her interpretation on the origins of white supremacy culture in Washington, D.C. She is the author of The ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors, published in 1991. Here is Welsing speaking on Sunday.
Let me just begin by sharing with you, those of you who have heard me speak before, have heard me say that I never intended to be talking to large numbers of people about racism. But when I did my training, residency training at St. Elizabeth's Hospital here in Washington, 1963 to 1966, I started wondering what was making black people mentally ill. I'm a third generation black physician. My father was a physician in Chicago, and his father was a physician in Chicago who died in 1909. My grandfather, according to my grandmother, she said, your grandfather was a race man, meaning that he put what was happening to black people as a priority. And so I'm a race woman. But I was wondering what was making black people mentally ill. And in the training program, there were very few black residents, maybe two. And all of the people who were training us, they were psychoanalysts and psychiatrists in this area. And we were actually told that black people didn't have the intellect to benefit from psychotherapy, that the best treatment for black people was medication. Well, that didn't compute in my brain computer. And in taking history, of course, we have white patients and black patients. I believe as a physician, you try to get everybody well. But in the histories of black patients, there was always something major throughout the history about racism. And I decided, well, if I'm going to help black people, I need to deal with this thing called racism. I went from 3 years of residency at St. Elizabeth's to 2 years of child psychiatry fellowship at Children's Hospital. And we were up at 1325 Douglas Street. That's now, I think, YMCA or something else. But I was, again, continuing to be curious about what is racism. As an undergrad, I went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and I used to think of myself as a Marxist. And Marx had the concept that everything was tied to, I like things to be tied in a package, so you're not understanding just one thing, you're trying to understand things as they interrelate. And as I said, I was 16 and I thought I was a Marxist. And I remember going home and sitting at the dining room table with my parents and my grandmother. And I just announced, I'm a Marxist. And my grandmother said, the more education they get, the dumber they get. But make a long story short, it's one thing to have concepts when you are in college, all kinds of concepts. When you become a physician and you're responsible for the health and well-being of people, you need to have another level of understanding. And so I'm looking for what is the answer about racism beyond what Karl Marx had said. And I had the good fortune, you know, they say when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And so I'm looking for what is racism, this question in the back of my mind. And at a social gathering after a Black Power Committee meeting, the Black Power Committee used to meet on U Street, I think just below 13th Street across from Ben's Chili Bowl. And that was when Stokely Carmichael and all the people who had come out of the civil rights struggle, they became a part of the Black Power Committee here in Washington, D.C. And after one of the meetings, we were sitting around eating African food at somebody's house, and I heard a gentleman on the other side of the room. This black man said, racism is a system. Now, I'm a psychiatrist, fellowship in child psychiatry, looking for this answer to be effective in treating patients. Something that I felt I needed to understand beyond Marx, beyond Freudian psychoanalytic theory. And this black man turned out to be Neely Fuller Jr. How many people are aware of his work? Mr. Fuller was a guard at the Bureau of Engraving. He was not a medical doctor. He was not a psychiatrist. He didn't have a college degree. But he had a brain that could work. He said that he was on a radar site in Japan during the Korean War. And he started thinking about all of the kinds of discussions that would go on in this part of the world about segregation, desegregation, etc. And he said, sitting on that mountaintop, all of that didn't make sense. And he started conceptualizing that racism was a system, total system structure. And so when I heard that, it was like a light bulb went on. And he said that the system was about maintaining a particular power equation. White power over a relative non-white powerlessness. I used to live on Fairmont Street, 740 Fairmont, apartment 106. And Mr. Fuller and myself, and I had another colleague who was training in orthopedic surgery. His name is Carl Hutchinson. He's now deceased. The three of us would sit up in my apartment till 3 o'clock in the morning, tossing ideas back and forth. And Carl Hutchinson, Neely Fuller had a suitcase with about 1,800 pages of precisely written, hand-printed pages about his concept of a system that covered all areas of people activity. Economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. And that the system controlled patterns of thought, speech, and action. And that was a very profound concept. To me, that was as important as Einstein saying E equals MC squared. Nellie Fuller said, racism, white supremacy is about the power equation of white power over a relative non-white powerlessness. So I started thinking about, you know, I started saying, well, why? Why would they? That's the question in science that little two-year-old children understand. Like little children, when they're beginning to talk and to start thinking, and you say something to them and they say, why? I mean, they will wear out those three letters. Why? And adults who are around children get annoyed. In the future, don't ever get annoyed. You might have to say you don't know the answer. But the child is looking for cause and effect. So they begin to understand what is happening around them, really what is happening on the planet, what's happening in the universe. So the question about causation is not just the acceptance that thus and so is the case, but why is it the case? What is causing? So my question was about what is causing a system to be established on the third planet from the sun that we call Earth? What is causing the need to construct a particular power dynamic? And so I was actually in my apartment on Fairmont Street. See, I'm looking for answers, not just to be cute. I'm looking for answers in order to be an effective physician. Now, there was nothing about racism in the training program in psychiatry. There's nothing about racism in the fellowship in child psychiatry at Children's Hospital. The only thing they used to say when I was training in child psychiatry is that Francis can get all of the children well. Francis holds the hands of the little white children as well as the hands of the little black children. Now just imagine that being big news. But again, this question, why? And so I started thinking about all of the things that are said in this system dynamic and the system structure. And one of the important things that was said, that certainly black people, any people who lived in this culture have heard it, that black people are genetically inferior compared to people who classify themselves as white. Has everybody heard that? Is anybody who hasn't heard it? No hands, right? Everybody's heard that. So I started thinking about that. And I started thinking about, see, if you stay in school long enough and you read enough, repeat after me, reading.
Reading
is more important,
than
watching TV. See, everybody's house ought to be filled up with books. Kick the television out and put some bookshelves in. But if you spend time, enough time in school, and enough time reading, then you're moving beyond what might be talked about on a given television channel. And so I just started thinking, what are the things that are said in the culture? And one of the things that was said is that the people of color are minorities. And I said, wait a minute. On this planet, 9/10 of the people have color. There's only a tiny minority of people that have the absence of color in their skin. So I said, now that's significant. And the other thing, that they were supposed to be genetically inferior. And I said, but wait a minute. See, again, just going back all the things that you learn, certainly in science, that black the ability to produce this skin pigment is a genetically dominant trait. Now, there might be some people in the audience who did take genetics, but all you have to do is look at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. President Barack Obama is an example of black genetic dominance. His father was black. His mother was white. So black being a genetic dominant trait, white being a genetic recessive trait, there was no way that President Obama was going to turn out to be anything but colored. So that is explanation of genetic dominance, and that always is the case. It's not some of the time, it's all of the time that black is a genetically dominant trait. So what I thought about was, if everybody can see this, just imagine that this circle is the planet. And let's say this is Europe. That in the 15th century, Columbus started voyages, people in this part of the world, circumnavigating the planet. And everywhere those boats landed, any place they encountered colored people. This was the only area where there were white people, this tiny area up here. If the men were sexually frustrated after all those months on the sea, and if the population was overly generous, you know, people of color can get overly generous in forgiving and all kind of other activities. But if the men took 9 months to get their boats repaired and reprovisioned, they realized that all the children looked like the mother. And then they started thinking, I guess, well, what if these guys got in boats and started going this way? That would be a problem. It's a problem right now in Europe, because you have people from the southern part of the planet, because there's all kind of chaos and starvation and unemployment, they're moving into Europe. But something critical begins to happen. And that even takes us to what's his name, Mr. Dylan Storm Roof. See, all of these problems, there's not a problem that you can bring up that is not related to the dynamic of racism. And one of the things, see, racism is the topic that people want to talk about least of all. It's like the big elephant under the rug. And that elephant can begin to stir. Some people have expressed it, a truth crushed to earth will always rise. You see, so even though people don't want to talk about racism, then you end up with Ferguson, or you end up with Cleveland, or you end up with Staten Island, or you end up with Charleston, South Carolina, and Mr. Roof bringing it to our attention. Well, anyway, if these people start going this way, I said that they could have had a conference on the ship. They didn't have to have a big, huge institute to start thinking, wait a minute, we got a problem here. What will happen? And see, Dr. Martin Luther King, a brilliant social scientist, activist, courageous leader. He said, everybody should love. Now that's wonderful. Would that happen? But if everybody on the planet, with all these colored people, started loving, and love can be expressed in sex. What will happen if all these colored people in the 1/10 population on the planet that is white, if everybody started loving, what would happen? White would disappear. White would disappear. Now, I've talked to audiences of white people. I said, do you want your children to be colored? Do you want your grandchildren to be colored? Do you want your great-grandchildren to be colored? Do you want your great-great-great-great-grandchildren to be colored? I'm polite and they're polite. What do they say?
No.
No. See, I don't get upset. I say simply, if you mean this, then you have to do certain things in economics. You have to do certain things in education, certain things in entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, in order to maintain white power over non-white powerlessness. This is the equation for white genetic survival on the planet.
If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on 89.3 WPFW in Washington. We've been listening to the voice of Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, who packed the room Sunday at Busboys and Poets with a talk not just about race, but about racism. After the break, we'll be talking about the crisis of care for our elders, the crisis in home care, and Monday's White House Conference on Aging with Caitlin Connolly of the National Employment Law Project. It's also your turn. You can call 202-588-0893 with your comments or questions about anything on today's show. We'll be right back after this break. That was Golden by Jill Scott on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on WPFW 89.3 FM, where we're going to next talk about the golden years, how our elders experience their health care, and how those who care for them, home care workers, are treated. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm joined via Skype this morning by Caitlin Connolly of the National Employment Law Center. She's the Home Care Fair Pay Campaign Coordinator working to ensure home care workers receive the labor protections afforded through the Fair Labor Standards Act. Caitlin joined NELP after serving as the project director of the Elder Care Workforce Alliance, a coalition of 30 national organizations committed to providing older adults quality care by strengthening the workforce trained to care for them. She has also worked as senior project manager at the American Geriatric Society. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning, and hi, Esther. Thanks so much for having me here today.
Well, Caitlin, you recently wrote in your blog that with 10,000 people turning 65 every day, 9 in 10 of them wanting to remain at home, these are your words, the need for caregivers is growing fast. But with fewer family caregivers available, the only way we will meet the rising demand for long-term services and supports is if we invest in quantifiably value home care workers. And you say how? By providing them family-sustaining wages, benefits, paid time off, paid sick leave, support, training, and other opportunities for advancing. So will Monday's White House Conference on Aging address this crisis?
You know, I'm very hopeful. I think when we look, home care workers provide 70 to 80% of the paid hands-on care that people receive. And so if people are going to remain in home, age in place, have that person-centered care that identifies their values and what they would like to see happen, then really our long-term services and supports plan, our long-term care plan for the future, is going to hinge on this workforce. And right now, there is alarmingly high turnover, estimated at least 50% a year, increased burnout. There is increased cost associated with that turnover and burnout. And we are just not able to attract or retain amazing quality workers because of the working conditions.
So I also know that there are legal obstacles in the path of home care workers. The Supreme Court's decision in Harris versus Quinn, for example, it dealt a very serious blow to the effort of home care workers to unionize. And then there's a current case challenging, I guess, longstanding rules that deny home care workers basic labor protections. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. So the National Employment Law Project has been proud to be working for years with committed allies for fair pay and justice for home care workers. Back in 1938, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, it guaranteed minimum wages and standard hours to most workers. But domestic workers and agricultural workers were intentionally excluded, with many members of Congress justifying that exclusion because they were jobs that were predominantly held by African Americans. Mm-hmm. So in 1974, Congress returned and aimed to correct the unjust and racist exclusions by trying to extend minimum wage and overtime protections to almost all domestic workers. But they created a carve-out for casual babysitters and companions for the aged or infirmed. Mm-hmm. And then the Department of Labor, when they sort of defined what that companionship exemption was, they really defined it quite broadly, and so home care workers were included. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there really wasn't a home care industry. If you were older and you became sick, or you weren't necessarily able to remain independent at home, then chances were you went to a nursing home or you resided with a family member. Since 1974, the home care industry has grown leaps and bounds. And so we really need to make sure that these workers are recognized as the workers that they are, doing the very strenuous work that they do.
Right. You know, it occurs to me that, you know, in the current debate over, for example, the Confederate flag and the flag being more of a symbolic, removing it being a more symbolic victory, people are also talking about issues just like this, that there are actual policies that more reflect the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, in addition to just the flag. And I know that there was a paper I read, I think, from the ACLU, and I'm sorry I don't have her name right in front of me. I definitely want to give her credit, an attorney there who just made this point that how home care workers are treated, as you mentioned, is this legacy of them being excluded originally, along with agricultural workers, which were predominantly African American, and there are people actually trying to hold on to that in 2015. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that was Ariella Migdal.
Thank you for
she was at the ACLU. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, came out with that point, you know, really made these connections. And I think, you know, it is a workforce that today is 90% women. A majority are women of color. And I think that much of the exclusion, or the reason for that exclusion, still continues, as Ariella pointed out, to the legacies of Jim Crow. And, you know, I think one other point.
Hold that point. I think we have a caller. Do we still have our caller? We have two callers, so I just want to, people are calling into the show to make some comments, so I want to take them, and then we'll get back to our discussion. So our caller, first caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air. All right. Yes, my name is RG, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. Did shift the focus of the discussion today to home health care. However, I did want to speak on Dr. Welsing, if I might. If that's something you allow.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Yes, some 30 to 35, I guess almost 40 years ago, WPFW was in its incipient stages at that point, really just before 1977. Dr. Welsing's sister, Lauren Kress Love, was a program director, and basically everything associated with starting up PFW. And I find that Dr. Welsing's theory of color confrontation has held up over the decades and has reached a wider audience. However, I think that PFW certainly has at least a tangential association with Dr. Welsing via her sister. And so I thought that should be noted.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for informing us, more newer comers, right?
Okay. She was one of my heroes when I was entertaining med school back in the day. Maybe it's still not too late. We'll see. Thanks.
Okay, and thank you for calling. And take the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, my sister.
Good morning, Tesfa.
Racism rests on institutions in other races. For example, divide and conquer, like the colonial powers. Colonialism could be also connected to racism, and racism rests on institutions of divide and conquer, and that is happening in Rwanda, Congo, and Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, the government is financed by the United States. The United States having racism in its institutions and in its beliefs. The Ethiopian government is the best example of an institution built by racism.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Tesfa. So if you want to also join the discussion, you can call 202-588-0893. You can talk about anything on today's show. Right now, I'm actually talking to Caitlin Connolly of the National Employment Law Project, and we're kind of just mashing it all up here. We're talking about the care for our elders, the plight of home care workers, and really how this legacy of racism and exclusion continues to impact them. In 2015, there's going to be a big conference on Monday called the White House Conference on Aging right here in D.C. And this issue, we're wondering if it's going to be square on the table, and you have high hopes for it, Caitlin, right?
I believe that if we are going to meet the long-term care needs of older adults, and I think that we can also look at the health disparities that exist, racial health disparities, racial and ethnic, and gender disparities that exist amongst older adults receiving care. If we are going to meet both of those challenges, we are going to truly need to invest in the home care workforce. And I think that within the White House Conference on Aging, they are tackling many issues. One of them is long-term services and supports. And we know that the needs that individuals have to live as high a quality life as they can in the best quality health care are often tied to those services and supports that people receive. So we absolutely need to make sure that we are both meeting the needs of individuals, but doing so by meeting the needs of workers and abiding by the rights of workers.
How about here in D.C.? I know that you've been very connected with the D.C. home care workers who are, you know, like their brothers and sisters around the country, working without paid sick days, you know, because of their organizing for the past year. They have received the city's living wage, most of them anyway, and there's still this battle about getting the basic labor protections that other people have. So just for the folks who may not know, you know, how is this related right here in our own backyard?
Sure. Well, so we know there's, according to PHI, which is an organization that collects data on direct care workers, including home care workers, there are probably about 7,500 home care workers in the District of Columbia. They are, like I said, doing the critical work that allows for people to stay at home. So these jobs are only expected to grow. So, again, according to PHI, by 2022, personal care jobs are expected to grow by 44%, home health jobs by 54%. So these are two of the fastest growing jobs in the district. All other occupations in D.C. are only expected to grow by 8%. So right. We know that this is where the jobs are, this is where the need is, and we must invest in making sure these are quality jobs, not only to improve the conditions workers face, but also for D.C.'s economy. You right. do not want to have the fastest growing jobs in the district being poverty wage jobs or low wage jobs.
Yeah, and substandard in terms of how they're treated in relationship to other workers.
Absolutely. Right. And I think, you know, one of the things you said, paid sick time, paid vacation time, benefits, things that help to stabilize the workforce. Another thing that faces home care workers that is unique to some other roles is scheduling. You know, it is so hard to schedule your week if you don't have consistent hours. And this is traditionally one of the jobs where it's actually often very hard to get full-time work. About 40%, 47% nationally of home care workers are part-time or full-time for only part of the year.
Okay. We actually have two more callers, so we're going to go to the lines. Let me take the first caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Is that me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Thank you. My name is Malay. I'm calling from Washington. And thank you for at least the view that you led me to speak it. And let me begin. I live here in Washington area for the last 33 years now. And I've been living, especially in Washington, D.C., I'm talking in Washington, D.C., 34 years. And I've been dealing with brothers and sisters of so-called African-Americans, but black society like me. I don't like to say African-American or that kind of thing. I'm black, all of us. And look, Mr. Tussle was talking before me that about racism. I don't think Mr. Tussle knows what it means, racism. I don't think he knows. We Ethiopians or Africans or any black society on the world, we are all of us one race. Race means who does not look like you or who is disassociated from your skin. So let me begin here from Washington. I've had many African Americans. You foreigners came, took our job. You foreigners are here. When I look at it, when I tell them, look, don't you think we all of us are runners and we are black societies and we are victimized by the system? They don't look at that. But when you look at, when they see European, whether from Russia, from Yugoslavia, from London, they don't land at home. They don't put finger on him. And I'll give an example, like in Berlin, Ethiopia, we were trying to stop this here on a 9th Street area, downtown here. You know who was against us? Our brothers and sisters in black. And they were the Chinese community. They did not point the finger on them. So we have to know what we are doing. We're saying, not only that, we are here because of this threat. The whole human race is under the imprisonment of Europeans because we could not do anything. Okay. This is totally imprisonment. And Mr. Tussle, I've been here many times. He's my brother, but He is confused. He has to know what means racism.
Okay. I couldn't make out everything that you're saying. I think I'll tell this caller, I couldn't make out his name, but tell this caller and all callers that when you call in, don't scream. Don't scream into the cell phone, because what you're saying is largely unintelligible, and it raises the, it makes the sound quality of the show really diminished, okay? But what I could get from him, I want to relate to our conversation a little bit, because we have among home care workers in D.C. a number of women from that, or who are from the continent of Africa and West Africa, as well as Ethiopian and from East Africa. And so we have in this population of largely women of color, people who are born here in the United States and people who are born in Africa and the Caribbean. And what happens is that, you know, people are coming together. They're finding ways to unite in terms of their similarities, the things that they have in common, as opposed to their differences. The society is almost kind of set up in a way to kind of pit people against each other, people who've been here a long time versus newcomers, everybody scrapping for a job, for pay. So we have to be really conscious of that when we're talking about any type of discussion about the diaspora or labor or any of those issues. And so in that way, I want to kind of connect what he's saying to our discussion. But please don't yell. Don't yell. And we have one more caller. Go ahead, caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi. My name is Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling from Washington, D.C. And I was just wondering, a couple of years ago, when the federal government shut down, friends of mine who are home health care workers didn't receive a paycheck.
Right.
And the company they worked for said it was because of the federal government shutdown. And I thought, that must be illegal, because my father had a small business, and if the people he was selling to didn't pay him, he still was obligated to go out and get a loan to pay the workers. So I was wondering what the legal recourse, do people have any legal recourse when something like that happens?
You know, Caitlin, I know you can take this, but I can kind of fill her in real quick because I'm kind of running out of time. But there's actually several lawsuits against some of those same agencies that you're talking about by home care workers who were denied their pay. And not only denied pay during the government shutdown and then the agencies didn't pay, but for years back when these agencies were not paying the city's living wage, were not paying paid sick days, paid overtime, and other things that they were legally entitled to. So that's part of the ongoing struggle for the D.C. home care workers. Do you want to add anything, Caitlin? We're kind of running out of time, but do you want to have any final comments?
I would just say, you know, in talking to workers who did work during that time, it is because, they are in a very unique position where people are counting on receiving care. And
right.
You're talking about workers who said, I care for my clients and want to make sure that they are being taken care of at this time.
Right. Okay. So thank you, Caitlin, for joining me for this segment today. Thank you so much for your expertise and knowledge. And we're certainly going to be down there at the White House on Monday at the White House Conference on Aging to see what happens inside and outside.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. And so that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram. Thanks to my guest, Caitlin Connolly of the National Employment Law Project. Thanks to Maskila Washington for her production assistance with Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing. And thanks to my engineer, Mike. Thank you so much for listening, calling in, and supporting your station for jazz and justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. If you'd like to work on the show, we have open positions for volunteers and interns. Write us at contact@onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace.